So welcome to Foundations. This is the third of this 4 series, and I see some of you who have been here for almost all of them. And are there folks who this is their first Foundations? Yeah? Are you intimidated that you are coming in midstream? Not until I said something? Yeah? Yes. Well, we're going to start with a review, and then we're diving into this class is on the theology and anthropology of covenant. And we're going to dive into what that means and what the implications are, and we're going to play in some of these concepts today. So I think we're in for a show. And I'm going to start, though, with one of my favorite readings. This is from Governor John Winthrop, and I think I use this in church. So Governor John Winthrop was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so these are the first of the Puritans to come over from England. And he is standing on the deck of the ship with all of the settlers, and he's giving this sermon on Christian charity. And he basically lays out, like, how are we going to be living in this new land? And he starts with this phrase, now the only way to avoid shipwreck. And I just like the imagery of him standing on the deck of the Arbella as they're about to like launch into this perilous journey of like real danger of shipwreck. But he talks about the only way we're going to avoid shipwreck is for us to have a new way of relating to one another. And so this is what he says. Now, the only way to avoid shipwreck and to provide for our prosperity is to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our work and commission. Got cut off here. Always having before our eyes the commission and community in the work as members of the same body. So shall we keep the unity of spirit and this bond of peace. And what's amazing is, Winthrop is, documenting the burgeoning colony and what life was there. And, his journals are like, after about a year, you just see he's just recording like petty squabbles. And people are fighting. And people aren't getting along. And it's getting hard. And you look back at this kind of idealized vision of what he thought it was going to be like, that they were going to take each other's conditions and then they're going to support each other for posterity, that was the way it was going to be. And then you read his journals in which that's not happening at all, and there's like a little bit of heartbreak in there. And that's kind of what we're going to get at today, which is this vision of covenant and this aspiration of what it would be like to live with each other in this way, and yet the reality of not being able to get there. And what does that say about the ultimate? What does that say about us? And how does that play out in the church? So that's the vision of what we're going to do today. There's a distinction in the Cambridge platform between the church universal and the church militant. And the distinction is the church universal is this kind of the communion of saints, of all of these people who are working towards this goal of, world community, of the kingdom of God. But the church militant is the actual people who are in covenant explicitly with each other. And so there's like this distinction between these two realms, and we're gonna talk a little bit about that. Is your question like, where did this covenant thing come from?
Well, or it's just a new...
Okay, yeah. So I was talking with Susan Ritchie, who's a UU historian, and she has looked at the history of covenant, and she says about 1985 was the moment in which UU started to have a new cognizance about covenant. And that was the time in which, at the Unitarian Universalist Association, there started to be talk of churches being in covenant with one another. And this was in relation to UUA dues, in terms of the money that each church pays to support the Unitarian Universalist Association, our association. And there was an understanding of that money being part of a covenantal relationship. And as we kind of talked about last week, the rise of religious language, I think, ushered in a spaciousness to start playing in a theological world in which covenant was accepted and not just pushed away or secularized as something that's just about behavior. But that's my guess. So your question about the halfway covenant. All right. I don't know if we have time to go into that, but we can talk about that.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the UU understanding of what covenant means and what the like dominant mainstream Christian definition of what covenant means? Because every time I hear covenant, I think Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant, and mm-hmm. it's not helpful in yeah. understanding this.
Yeah, that's great. I doubt any of us will be melted today. Maybe frozen. Well, let's dive into kind of a little review of where we've been so far, and I think we'll get to some of these questions. So this is the covenant diagram. So covenants are agreements or promises that are made at the intersection of three things: the intersection of self, or you, others, and something ultimate. So this ultimate could be the power of love, the power of human potential. It could be God, depending on your theology. But this is kind of an understanding that there's something greater than just ourselves and other people that form our world and that we can tap into or be in relationship with. And the promises that one makes in this kind of Venn diagram come together as a covenant, and what holds it together is the promises that we're making to each other. So, but this is not just... And one of the things I like to think about is if you have an agreement or promises made between yourself and other people, that's basically a contract, right? And yourself and something ultimate, that's kind of like a pact you're making with God. You know, a lot of times you'll think of, you're in a bad spot. You're like, God, if you just do this, maybe I'll do this. That's kind of a pact. But the intersection of being in relationship with not only what do I need, what do other people need, and what am I called to most deeply in this world by that sense of ultimacy, of who we could be together if we were our best selves. The aspirational part that John Winthrop is talking about on the Arbella, that sense of what we find in the middle is that covenantal relationship. And the covenant, though, is not, by necessity, isn't turned in on itself. It's directed outwards. Because if we're called to something more ultimate, whether that be God or love, courageous love, or even just human potential, that is going to orient the way we are in our relationships to be in relationships with other people, or to be different with other people in our lives, or be a different way with other people. There's an orientation of covenant that is outwards and is directed towards closing the gap between our aspirations, or what love, if love ruled the world, what that would look like, and where we are now. And so the orientation of these relationships and these promises that we make is trying to lower that gap together. Now, this is a very Unitarian Universalist understanding of covenant. Because if you go back to kind of the Puritan understanding of covenant, the Puritans saw themselves, you know, the individual Puritan with other people and with God forming a covenant which they thought of as the militant church or as the church. So each covenant of people coming together, promising to walk with each other on the journey of life, that formed a church. But this kind of sense of God, this ultimate, was a very specific God. And so Puritans, for example, thought that they had a special relationship with God to be a city on a hill in which they were going to, with God's help, be a beacon to what living Christianity should look like. So that was their kind of part of that understanding of what is ultimate. And in Unitarian Universalism, we don't have such a definite understanding of what the ultimate that we're in relationship with. That's one of the distinctions. Most of us, though, have experienced covenant on Sunday mornings, right? We say together our covenant, which is this list of aspirations of what we're called to be with each other. Love is the spirit of this church. And this is our great covenant. And to help one another. Right. So that's most of our understanding of covenant, is these aspirational statements about who we are. But as we've kind of been delving into covenant, it's more than just that agreement. There's something about us being in relationship with life itself, that there's some sort of responsibility that we are invited into by virtue of us being human. And that's part of what we're going to be exploring today.
Yeah, the degree of overlap. can vary. So, you know, Unitarians are probably at the more narrow end as to how many aspects of life they incorporate into the covenant.
Okay, so you're saying the degree to which these circles are disconnected or not. And I think we talked about last week when sometimes the self can be excluded from what can seem to be a covenant, in which you seem to be are asked if you want to be in relationship or to make the promises or to live faithfully, you have to take a part of yourself and push it down. And we talked about how that probably isn't actually a faithful reading of what covenant is, because covenant includes yourself. With that being said, I want you to find a partner. So now I want you to turn to your partner, and I want you to talk about what the phrase pinky promise means to you, and your experiences or any stories you have related to making a pinky promise or a pinky swear. Okay? Has everyone heard of what a pinky promise? Oh, interesting. Okay. So if you haven't heard about it, we'll dive deeper in a sec. But in your partners, have you heard of this phrase? What does it mean to you? What do you think it is? And if you've done it, what was it like? All right. I want to pull you back and just sample. You're probably like, what is he doing? Just sample one or two. What is a pinky? Can someone tell me what a pinky promise or a pinky swear is? Lindsay?
Okay, so you put your pinky around somebody else's pinky like this, and you say pinky promise, and then you tell them what the promise is. So it's usually like a childhood girls game, right? So that's at least how I remember it from elementary school. And it's a special promise. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't just say it for anything. You would only say it if it's something very special, like, please don't tell anyone about the boy I like or something, right?
The really important things.
Very, very important.
Other people's, who has made a pinky promise when they were a kid? Okay. There's a generational thing going on here. That's fascinating. So, but in your partners, I want you to just think about a time in which you've made a promise to someone. And what did it feel like to make a promise to someone? So call to mind a moment. And what did it feel like to make a promise? And just, you don't have to share what the promise is, but talk about what the emotional or interior experience was like when you were making a promise to someone else. Could be a big promise, a wedding vow. Could be a small promise, like, yes, I'll put the dishes away tonight. But like, what is that kind of inner experience like of making a promise? I'll give you a few minutes to do that. All right, I'm going to call you back. I'm not giving you much time. Sample a few. What does it feel like to make a promise?
It just brought to mind when I promised something to my kids, like a birthday's coming up, and this is all out of stock. You can't get it anywhere in town. I promise, I'll get it. So it's like a big responsibility and maybe a pressure that you put on yourself out of love.
There's like a feeling of a magnitude of something. Other experiences of making a promise.
It creates vulnerability, and it's an intimacy.
Mm. I think it's also a way to show that you belong somewhere. Like, I will hold this information safe for you, and which is showing that, like, we're in this together, and, like, we have each other's backs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyone have another kind of note to hit that they kind of came up when you were talking about?
I said that it can kind of almost touch upon the sacred, you know, especially wedding vows, and that kind of your promise is your word, and that's all you have.
What she said was she kind of sits up more, takes it really seriously, and it's like a responsibility.
I noted that I learned something from the promise that I was thinking of, and that was that sometimes I can't complete the promise by myself. Mm. It's with somebody else, as well as with the sacred, the ultimate, whatever you want to call it. And although my intentions were to do it, it did not work by myself.
You're teeing me up, Lori.
Like most things I experience in life, I would say there's a bit of anxiety that goes along with that, because I'm always afraid that I am going to mess it up or break it, or something out of my control might happen that will keep me from fulfilling the promise.
So fragility, maybe, of ourselves or what we're trying to do.
It shouldn't be coerced.
Now, yes, I mean, covenants have to be free. You have to freely enter into them. You can be offered them, and we can put it on a platter and invite you in, but there's nothing that we can do to force you into a covenant. But I think sometimes the promises we make can sometimes feel like they are coercive sometimes. And what I mean by that is that they sometimes limit us. Like, there is things that we can't do now that we've promised, right? So, like, there's a tension in the freedom, because they should be freely entered into, and yet once we enter into them, there's something that now is off limits. So there's kind of this play in this freedom. Okay, this is great. Now, I'm going to flip it. And just, I want us to think of, just take a moment about what the feeling, that internal feeling, is like when a promise is broken. Either one. By you, by other people, like, what does it feel like to experience a broken promise? Disappointment? Sadness? Betrayal? What's another one I heard? Indifference? Shame? Guilt? Devastation? Anger? Higher priority. What do you mean by that? Heavy? Yeah? Right, because sometimes we break promises for very good reasons. Right? Failure? Escape? Yeah.
On the point of freedom, if you make a promise in a monogamous, committed relationship, then you're freed from the frustrations of the chase.
Right. And yet we know the devastation in many people's relationships, or a real time of re-understanding of relationships and what is important when those sorts of promises are broken. Right? This is great. So the reason why I started with the pinky thing, not knowing it was a generational thing, was because it actually comes from an ancient Japanese tradition in which, when promises were made, that kind of connection was made to seal it. And the implication was that if you betrayed that, you would lose your pinky. The pinky would be cut off as a mark of how important this promise was. And I think that it's easy to kind of look at that and see and think, okay, that's barbaric. Like, we would never want that in our society. And yet the feelings that come up, our experience of broken promises, I think at least when it's a truly meaningful promise to us and it is broken, the feelings inside of us may be akin to wanting to chop off someone's finger, right? Like, honestly, like, it's a real embodied, like, symbol of, I think, why promises are so essential. And so, and we're going to get into this anthropology piece, but why they're central to our humanness, and why, when they're broken and when they mean something, even for the best reasons, there's a part of us that feels this hurt and wants to do something about it.
I would also say that the reverse is true, that if you break a promise to somebody, you might feel the pain as if you did lose a pinky, and it's not just that you would want to hurt somebody when the promise is broken.
Yes. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our commission and community in the work as members of the same body. This element of this promise-making connects us. Like, when we make a promise, there is this connectiveness of our relationships in which we start to share this semblance of a body, of a connected community, and the wounds that are inflicted when the promises are broken or not, are kept or renewed or renegotiated, all of that, there's a corporeality of it, and these feelings, I think, point to that. Great. So with that kind of embodied understanding of promises as they are at the center of what it is to be in covenant, we then kind of get to turn to the difference between it, what is a theology of covenant versus an anthropology of covenant. And Alice Blair Wesley, in one of her lectures, I think it's the last lecture that I think we may have handed out previously, she says this: theology is our understanding of what is holy, most precious, most salutary, most worthy of our devotion. And our theology is our understanding of the way things are and should be and could be with us as humans. So theology is what is most holy, what is most sacred, what is most ultimate, the kind of study or exploration of that, this kind of ultimate sense. And anthropology is this study or exploration of what does it mean to be human? What could we be as humans? What should we be as humans? There's ethical dimensions of that. There's how we live and how we practice. And so when we talk about what I've been thinking about recently is how covenant, this practice, knits together our theology and an anthropology, right? The promises we make about what is most ultimate and the way we want to live in the world, that kind of theological construction of what is ultimate, it can only redeem or be made real in our anthropology with some sort of connective tissue between the two. Right? Does that make sense? Am I making things up? No? Okay, I might be. That's what we do in seminary. And I think that covenant, these promises, are what bridges the gaps between our understanding of what we can be as humans and what we should be as humans with that kind of ultimateness, that kind of trajectory of where we're going. Jewish theologian Martin Buber famously said that humanity is inextricably bound to our promises. He called us promise-making, promise-breaking, promise-renewing animals. John Burens, who was president of the UUA for some time, said this: I believe that we humans are not so much homo sapiens, we are neither that wise nor that self-aware, but rather we are the animal that makes promises. We ourselves are created in the context of relationships, promises, and commitments. We then either break them or make new ones, modify them or renew them. To use a word deeply rooted in our culture, we are covenantal by nature. I think what that gets at is this anthropology of who we are as humans is made real by the promises that are made. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into that. It feels quizzical right now. But before we do that, I want to get to this dimension of time. So if you look at the etymology of covenant, it comes from, or sorry, the etymology of promise. It comes from 13th century Latin, which is to send forth, to let go, to foretell, to assure beforehand. So the grounding sense of what a promise is a declaration made about the future in the present for what should be done, what could be done, or what should not be done. There's a futurizing of the present into the future that a promise represents, right? When you make a promise, you're saying, in the future, I will be, do, not do, make sure I do, all of this. There's a connection between what is happening now and what's happening in the future. So it reaches across time and weaves into the fabric of possibility, this promise. And I think what happens in that action of making a promise, is we're creating an intention towards a certain end, but we're also realizing in some ways that the most transformative things, so if we're talking about the biggest promises we could make, or the ways of being that we want our world to inhabit, the big transformations that we would want, we can promise each other that. We can promise and say, it'll be okay in 100 years. Or don't worry, war will end. But for that to be meaningful, there has to be some sort of undergirding of that, which is action, but also an acknowledgement that we can't actually make any of that real in the future without other people. Fundamentally, promises are about invoking a connection with other people, about changing the world in the future. And that's why they're so meaningful. They're also so destructive when they break. Laurie.
I think of a promise as a projection into the future, but it's only made real by each choice and action that I make in the now.
Right.
Because yesterday is gone, tomorrow is not here yet. All I have is now to deal with. So I have to support that promise with each decision, action, or non-action, as the case may be, in the now.
Exactly. So what I want to spend our last little time exploring is, like, what are the implications of that reality for us? What does it mean to be human, to have that as the reality, that we make promises that are broken, that may be renewed, and that ultimately, for us to achieve what we envision in the world, we need other people to promise and work with us? What does that mean to be human in that context? Because that, I think, gets at this anthropology of who we are and what we value.
Well, it seems to me that a promise is an acknowledgement that we are human. In other words, well, I can't just say, sure, I'll do that.
Right.
Do you promise? So it acknowledges that, yeah, sometimes humans don't do what they say they're going to do, but they promise. It's an acceleration of the next step. It's kind of a security thing. So, you know, it's, why didn't the, why was Winthrop, seeing all these squabbles? Well, because we're human.
Right.
And
I think it's very messy, is what it is. It's messy to be human. It's messy to make a promise, because in our humanness, we come from our stories. And our stories, in our stories, we have woundedness. And even with our deepest heart's intention to keep a promise, it's complicated. But the truth of it is that just in making the promise, there's a potential for healing and evolving and renewing. And so making promises are very important for the evolution of humankind, is kind of how I see it.
I think also all a promise is one person saying to another person, can I count on you? And the other person saying, yes, you can count on me. When it turns out you can't count on me, there's all those things at the bottom, betrayal, sadness, etc. But I think, in essence, the reason humans make promises and need to know that they can count on each other is because of the importance of community and having that extended trust. Mm-hmm. That you'll watch my kid play in the street. You won't pour poison on my tomatoes, you know.
Right.
We're all in this together kind of thing.
And I want to circle back to this concept of freedom, that although promises limit our freedom, there's something liberatory in them, right? The fact that we can count on each other to look after the kids in the street. That limits our freedom because I can't go and play video games in my house. I need to go and tend to them. But by doing that, there is a liberatory movement, because now children are able to play freely with each other, and I'm able to trust and feel safe in my community. All of that comes, there's a freedom that is impinged upon, that we freely enter into, that lets some sort of liberation come forward, which is why in our church community, it's not just about you and what is most ultimate. There are other people. And so when, some people say, I don't like the music in church, I say, well, do other people? I think that 80% of what goes on in church should speak to you, maybe even 60%. But you should know that the other 40% is speaking to other people, and that you can go anywhere else and maybe go to a concert, which is just the music you like, but you lose something in breaking off a relationship with people who are different than you.
So one thing that kind of concerns me about, if you say that being human is, in fact, making promises, if you turn it around and say, okay, so being human is also the ability not to make promises.
Yes.
So do we have that free will or whatever to decide that I'm not going to make promises, especially since there's such a evidence that they're ever kept? What's the point? Let's just don't make them. If we are promise-making animals, mm-hmm. where does that put someone that decides not to make promises?
Or what does it mean to the person who constantly breaks promises? Right, we're going to get into this. Karen.
You can correct me if I'm remembering this incorrectly, but I think this is a Whiteheadian concept. See the Venn diagram and the connections between the ultimate and self? Mm-hmm. This notion that as part of my promise making, I am counting on that part of myself that is part of the ultimate, that's godlike, whatever, to help me to become, to do what I say I was going to do, to be honest with myself and with others in terms of whatever that promise or covenantal relationship is, and that. And then in terms of the others, you see that the others have got being able to see the that ultimate, that God in others, mm-hmm. is mostly, I think, how we come to understand the ultimate, how we come to know what the divine or the godlike is like, because it's the only way we have is when we see it in ourselves and others.
Yes. That's so beautiful.
Did I pick Whitehead out of
the No, I think that is Whitehead. And what I love about that is it connects with what we say every single Sunday, or at least every single Sunday I've been here, which is we are a church that believes that each person has a part of the truth. And what that means, though, is that we need to somehow bring our truths together and be in relationship with each other with our truths for us to have more of the picture and to understand this ultimate thing deeper, and that we could just be around certain people or decide not to be in a more expansive community. It would be easier, but we would break off from connecting to some of this ultimateness. All right. One of my professors in divinity school, he loved close reading texts. And we would spend a whole 3-hour lecture on a paragraph. And we're not going to do that today. But this is a section of Alistair Wesley's lecture. And we're going to kind of walk through it. And I'm going to invite you to get into maybe groups of five let's do groups of five. And we're going to read a piece together, see if there are any questions, and then I'm going to give you a question to talk about in your group. All right? So find circles so you can face each other and see each other and have a little bit of spaciousness amongst each other. Who loves reading out loud? Anyone? Sally? Sally, I'm going to give you this microphone. And I'm going to invite you to read out the first paragraph.
We human beings are promising creatures in more than one sense. We are born with promise or potential, which we do not and cannot create, with the promise of intelligence, of appreciation, of creativity, of cooperation, and most importantly, of love. Our very capacities and capabilities are a gift to us of the way things are. Therefore, it is appropriate to begin our worship services with songs and prayers of praise and gratitudes for all gifts, not made by human hands, but by God. Even so, we are and ought to be pretty sparing in our use of the word God. It is a word easily abused and most authentically used as an exclamation in the face of wonder and splendor and mercy of our lives, even in the hardest of times.
Thank you. So, can someone summarize in a sentence what Wesley is saying by that? Pardon? The one I underlined? We are born with promise or potential, which we do not and cannot create. Yes, and I think that's her thesis, but as you see, we're going to walk through a few different understandings of what that means. So I would say that the one, the articulation would be that we are born with promise and potential which we do not create. And I want you in your groups to spend 4 or 5 minutes just talking about, when have I experienced the truth of that and what did it teach me? When did I experience the truth that we are all born with potential or promise which we didn't create? And what does that mean? All right? Okay, I think you can do it. You're giving me like weirded out faces. And it's late, but I think we're good. All right, I'll give you about 4 minutes to dive into that. All right, I'm going to pull you back. Who wants to do the next reading? Great. Thank you, Dave.
We human beings are promising creatures, too, in the sense that we can only do great and worthy things. Indeed, we can only survive when we make and keep promises of loyalty and faithfulness to the ways of love with others. For distinct and different as we are as individuals, we are also thoroughly social creatures. The options and choices we have as individuals are affected and affected by those of others. Our decisions and actions and inaction affect and affect many others. None of us can fulfill our promises as individuals without the faithfulness and loyalty of many others. Therefore, the aim of our worship services is a renewal of our sense of gratitude for and loyalty to the spirit of love, which summons and creates and recreates right loyalties within us.
So I would, if I was to kind of summarize that beautiful and eloquent thing in a sentence, I would probably point towards this conception of I am because we are. The flipping of Descartes, that, you know, if you think about a child being born into this world, there's nothing that child can do to raise itself. The only way that any of us are here is because someone or some people took a modest amount of interest in our well-being. And of course, it spirals out. The only reason why this church is here is because a group of people came together and decided that their love and loyalty was meant that we create it, that we enact it, that we be it. So I am because we are. I invite you again in your groups to think about the question, when have I experienced the truth of this and what does it teach me? And maybe if someone didn't get to speak the first time, invite them to share their story first. All right, I'm going to pull you back.
We human beings are also promise-breaking creatures. We violate our covenants in petty, small ways and in tragic, disastrous ways. Whether we do so out of sheer forgetfulness or poorly ordered priorities or ignorance or for motives we ourselves cannot admire, ill consequences are real for the whole interdependent web. Therefore, our worship services need to include time for reflection on our failures and mistakes, that we might be people of tender conscience, easily provoked to turn again toward the ways of love and do better tomorrow than we have done today. Love is a response to the loveliness, the charm, the good, the worth of another. To be lifelong, passionately religious lovers is to learn and practice the precious disciplines of paying attention and being still, receptive to the lure of that beyond ourselves, which awakens love in us. For when we rightly love, we rightly spend ourselves for the sake of the beloved and for the just character of our whole society.
So there's a lot going on there, but there's a movement in which what she's saying is that, to use kind of the Jewish conception of sin, of missing the mark, that the reality that we break promises as humans, that we can't like look into the future and always be faithful to our words for good reasons, for bad reasons, for impacts small and large, what that means is that there is this missing of the mark between what we wish we would be and what we can be. And that's the Jewish conception of sin, of, you know, an archery, of missing that mark, which, of course, brings up these feelings. So I invite you to think about that part of it. What have I experienced? When have I experienced the truth of that, of humans being promise breakers? And what did that teach me? I'll let you dive back in for a little bit. So the next paragraph goes on, and Wesley makes the connection that having an explicit covenant in a church allows us to return again and again to the promises that we make each other, and that when we break them, we're able to return again to mending that relationship, because covenants are about relationships, not rules. They're tending to our health of how we connect to each other, not just that you did something bad, and that's inherently not a good thing. It's relational. But I think what I love about this is that, and I highlighted these as claims, is she looks at our worship as kind of giving us an insight into the theology and anthropology of covenant. So she starts off and says that our worship needs to begin with praise, which was gratitude. This is connected to the grace. Being grateful for all that we've been given that hasn't been made by ourselves, for other people that have gifted us a promise that we are able to fulfill. That they need a time to cultivate gratitude and loyalty, which allows us to shift our loyalties to that of love. That we need a time of confession in which we think about sin, whether that be personal, collective, that we somehow miss the mark, that we break promises. And she makes this pivot and says, and having the explicit covenant of the church allows us to kind of be those promise renewers. But I think that there's a piece in, like, if we're being traditional in the liturgy, what happens after confession in a traditional Christian church is absolution. There's a moment in which the priest or the people say, and we're forgiven for this. I think that piece is essential to our understanding of the theology and anthropology of covenant, which is that our mistakes are not the end of the story. That's what I think about absolution. That our mistakes are not the end of the story. They're an invitation to a new way of being, which is what covenant is, inviting us into a new way of being, but they don't define the end of it. That it's a circle. It's an invitation to come back into the making of the promise again. And that our faltering doesn't define it entirely. All right, we have a few minutes of questions and thoughts. I'm sure you have some.
On those last two, confession and absolution, Unitarians tend to minimize, if maybe not have that at all, right? I mean, there's this evangelical bumper sticker that says, Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. And the Unitarians have a comeback. Not forgiven, not perfect, not responsible, just, pardon me, not perfect, not forgiven, just responsible.
I really like all this because even though we have the understanding that people aren't perfect, there's still this expectation of perfection that we put on others or we put on ourselves. And so I think so many people do feel like this mistake is the end. This is the end of the world for me. That's how it feels. And so to say, you know, it's a very positive, realistic way of looking at it. We're all humans. We all make mistakes. I'm going to get back on the horse and I'm going to try to do better next time. And it lets you be imperfect.
I love in this paragraph that the worship service helps to provide a pivoting. And this sentence here, it's just so sweet. I just love it. It's love is the response. Pivot back to love, and then it says, love is a response to the loveliness, the charm, the good, and the worth of another. That's so beautiful.
So the one part about absolution that kind of sticks in my throat is that you can be a rat your whole life, and then if you are contrite at the end, you somehow are forgiven, and all is made well. just can't quite get that.
And I wouldn't say that that is totally our theology of absolution, but we are universalists. So there is something in there.
You know, but you know, I've had a little experience with hospice. Mm. And one thing they work on in that environment is healing wounds. I don't know if you want to characterize it as absolution or not, but in a sense it is. And it has nothing to do with, you know, with God or anything like that, but I think it's very similar.
There is this sense that, you know, if what defines us as humans is our promises, our ability to make promises and break promises, what also defines us as maybe individuals or society is how we hold those promises. And if we hold them lightly, if we hold them deeply, and I think that's when, you know, when you're thinking about hospice or the end of a life, the things that may be with you are those broken promises, ones that you've made and ones that other people are made. And it is our community and it is our wish that everyone finds a space in which they can find to come to terms with that. And when we are living with each other in a church as a community in covenant, our hope would be that we find that way of living with one another in a renewing of our covenantal bonds, that we are able to release the hurt of the broken promise and find a new way forward that, you know, in Gretchen's words, that we'll all go there together. But in these moments, there is something of what does it mean to release each other from these promises that understands that because we are humans that break promises, that isn't the cardinal sin at the end of the day. And I think there's something in our universalist ethic that says, just maybe there's nothing that can push you beyond the pale of love. And that, you know, what I love about universalists in the 18th and 19th century is that they debated between two different positions. One position was restorationism, which meant that when you died, you went to a place to be redeemed before you went to heaven. And so some universalists thought of this as a fiery pit of hell that burned away all your sins so you could go to heaven. But it did it for everyone. So eventually everyone would be restored. Other people thought of it as just like boot camp. Like, you know, we're going to become a better person here and then you'll be into heaven. And the other universalists said, no, when you die, you're instantly redeemed. We all go there together, instantaneous. And there was always this tension. And I feel like it relates to how we hold each other accountable to those promises too. If we don't have a spaciousness in our heart that understands that we make promises, when it happens, we aren't able to get to that place of renewing in that same way. I commend you this sheet. Gretchen gave you a lot of handouts. I give you this one. Please go and read and reread it and play with it, because I think this is one of the distillations of what Wesley is saying about covenant in one place. And there's so much fruit here. So meditate on this, and we come back next time, and we're going to be talking about what is this movement from this I church of individuals to a place of we, of really living covenant in the 21st century. What does that look like? And I think this is a good guide for that.